We say it in many languages and many different theologies. Where charity and love prevail, there is where we find the holy. Now, as Scott and Carol Feldhusen come forward to light our chalice and mark the beginning of our sacred time, I invite you to reflect on the fact that what they are doing is taking a spark of the flame that burns within each of us to light a common flame. May that flame shine as a beacon of hope, of love, and justice. Invite you into worship with these words by Angela Herrera. Don't leave your broken heart at the door. Bring it to the altar of life. Don't leave your anger behind. It has high standards, and the world needs vision. Bring them with you, and your joy, and your passion. Bring your love, and your courage, and your conviction. Bring your need for healing, and your powers to heal. There is work to do, and all that we need to do it is here. So let us come in, and then reach beyond the walls of this church. Let us fill this sanctuary with love, and then harness its power to stop oppression. Let us join together in worship, and together, let us stand on the side of love. Got a few questions for you. I need your help with the message for all ages. What do we do if somebody treats someone else unfairly? An upstander. To stand up, I like that. You're going right to the theme. I like that very much. To be an upstander. Yes, to say something, to do something. But what do we do if it's bigger than just one person? If there's a law that treats certain people unfairly, or a law that makes it hard for a person to vote or get a good education? Lead a protest. We're going to move right through this service today. Okay. Yes, when people come together, sometimes we march together, sometimes we stand together to show that something is wrong, that we want it to change. There are speeches against certain laws or things that the government might be doing when we say that we think they're wrong. It might be called a protest, a rally, a march. It might also be called something else, too. We sometimes stand quietly with signs for peace or justice. We do it here every Thursday night out in front of the church. What do we call it when we stand quietly? A vigil. That's another way of standing up for what we value. I know many people in this church in the past have stood up against injustice, have stood for what's right, for peace, for justice, for equality. If you marched, and I know some of you did, in a civil rights march, if you participated in a rally for equal marriage or gay rights, if you participated in the Occupy movement rallies, if you stood at a peace vigil, if you've ever literally stood up for what's right and against what's wrong, I ask you to stand right now. Okay. And to our youth and to our children who are here, if someone's treated unfairly, if there's a law that treats people unfairly, what we hope you're going to do is do the same thing that they all do, and that is to stand up. We sang a song about standing up at the beginning of this service. Do you remember what it said? It said we're standing on the side of what?
Love.
That's what standing up against unfairness and injustice really is, and that's what we're doing right now. Sometimes we struggle. Sometimes things don't look good. Sometimes we feel empty, hurt, afraid. But our faith reminds us there is more. More love, more hope, more peace, more joy. There to bless our lives, there to find now within ourselves and then to share, to give away. With that hope and that love and that peace and joy within us, we can change our lives and bless our world. Let us in silence begin to now. I invite you now to be attentive to some words that Carol Feldhusen has to share with us.
Well, first of all, I have to say it's an honor to be giving a testimonial this morning. I describe myself as consistently inconsistent. However, this is only partially true. It's true of my fun, loving, and artistic side. I have discovered recently, because I'm always into self-awareness, if you know me, that I need more predictability in my life. So as I was thinking about this testimonial, I realized that First Parish feeds that predictability side of myself and my life. It has done so for 25 years. Scott and I actually figured that out last night, that it's been 25 years here at First Parish. I look to the people of FPC to provide me with that predictability piece, because at church, I count on certain things happening, people to people, and the connections that I make. Every Sunday, I turn around in my pew, and I look around, and I see who's here. I make eye contact with someone or a few people. I often smile at them, or I even wave. My children flourished in the RE program. Well, Tom really did. Elizabeth was always a harder sell. Scott taught me about church life. I had never gone to church before, so volunteering was the key. I jumped in at the memorial service receptions. I got to meet Marion Fletcher, and she's no longer with us. She passed on recently. And I met Marcia Rising. They were in charge of the memorial receptions. And they taught me really what to do at them. I learned a lot from them. Afterwards, I went home, and I remember saying to Scott that I really felt like I had been part of something integral to FPC, and I was amazed at what went on, that we had really provided a service for families of loved ones who had passed away. And I'm really proud that we continue this tradition, because Marion fretted at one point when she could not continue doing it, that it wouldn't continue. So I thank everyone who's doing that. I know Marion's spirit is around here somewhere. Another woman who is no longer with us is Bobby Head. Every now and again, she would stop me in coffee hour and say, "Carol, you're doing well now." You see, she was watching out for me, and it was funny. It always took me by surprise. Every Christmas Eve, when the candles are lit, I look up to the chandelier, the big round part, and I see the glowing flickers of the candles, and they look like little stars to me, and they're connecting each and every one of us. It's a very spiritual moment for me. A minister once told me there are the adults and the children of the congregation. And he said, we need both. He said, "Carol, you're one of the children." I agreed. I love fun, and humor. It's important to me. Here at church, I can find like-minded people. Speaking of fun, at the retreat, we have an impromptu workshop. You can't really advertise it, because I've dubbed it the Embarrassing Moment Workshop. You can't sign up for this. No one would really come because, well, it's embarrassing. So you have to come to the retreat, really, and if people want it, they ask for it now. So you have to sign up if you want to see what it's like. I did mention that I have two children who went through RE. Well, Virginia Benjamin, who does not get to church much anymore, would send me these little white envelopes in the mail, and they would often have newspaper clippings in them, and they would always be about Elizabeth's sports accolades. That was wonderful. One time recently, I missed a church service because I was in a deep conversation with a young mother here at church, and that was, sorry, Tom, the best church service I ever attended. And then, actually, it was her son one morning looked at me, and he sort of went like this, and I looked, and I thought, well, what's he doing? And I thought, oh, he wants to hug me. So I gave him a little hug back, and I thought, I asked his mom, and I said, does he hug often? Are you guys hug often? And she said, no. So I thought that was the sweetest thing, because I'm a big hugger. He knew I wanted a hug, so he tried. Fashion is a love of mine. It is an extension of the artist in me. Joanne Albright, who, again, is another person who's no longer with us, she loved hats, and she was into fashion to some degree. She approached me one time during coffee hour and asked me about my leggings. Well, they were called stirrup pants back then. And I told her, you know, they were stirrup pants. So her reply back to me was, I think I can wear those. And she was older. I thought she was older. I think I was kind of young. And she said, well, I think I can wear those. They're my best asset. And of course, I agreed. I have grown up in this church. One of the things that I value the most is how tolerant I have become. I used to be very quick to judge, literally shutting the door on people that were actually very nice. It was a pattern that I had learned from my home environment. I watched this pattern now. I believe that I would be a very different person if I had not been part of this congregation. Like the little flickers in the chandelier on Christmas Eve, I feel very connected, and each of us is connected to everyone. I'm connected to you, and you're connected to me. There's light here, and much, much more.
Thank you, Carol. like to share a reading with you from the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. It's from his letter from a Birmingham jail. Though I was initially disappointed at being categorized as an extremist, as I continue to think about the matter, I gradually gain a measure of satisfaction from the label. Was not Jesus an extremist for love? Love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you. Was not Amos an extremist for justice? Let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like a ever-flowing stream. Was not Martin Luther an extremist? Here I stand, I cannot do otherwise, so help me God. And John Bunyan, I'll stay in jail to the end of my days before I make a butchery of my conscience. And Abraham Lincoln, this nation cannot survive half slave and half free. And Thomas Jefferson, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. So the question is not whether you will be extremist, but what kind of extremists we will be. Will we be extremists for hate or for love? Will we be extremists for the preservation of injustice or for the extension of justice? The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. Do you know the quote? It's often attributed to Martin Luther King, Jr., but in truth, King took it from one of us, Unitarian minister Theodore Parker. Parker was a minister in Boston in the mid-1800s. He was a leader in the movement to combat the fugitive slave law, which required not only police, but all citizens, even those in states that prohibited slavery, to assist in returning escaped slaves to their master. Parker called the law a hateful statute of kidnappers. He refused to comply with the law and organized open resistance to it. He was a man of action, and he helped fugitive slaves reach freedom. From the pulpit and in the streets of Boston, he made clear that this was an immoral law, and he made clear where he stood. He stood boldly, unequivocally, on the side of equal worth and dignity for every person, on the side of freedom, against racism, against hate. And as we sang this morning, and as the banner on the front of our new building proclaims, on the side of love. Parker is one of my favorite Unitarian heroes from the past. For the time when he lived, his theology was very controversial. He taught that we were not required to believe the biblical stories about Jesus as facts, but what was required of us was to embrace the moral teachings in those stories that are true whether or not the stories are true. Whether or not Jesus miraculously fed 5,000 or whether or not he miraculously cured the sick, these stories tell us that we're called to feed the hungry, to have compassion for the sick, and to do what we can to relieve suffering. Parker answered the question we just asked in our last hymn, where is our holy church? For Parker, it was not what we believe about certain theological issues, but where we stand on the issues of our time that matters. Parker also knew that that moral arc of the universe of which he spoke did not bend on its own. It was by proclaiming to the world where we stand on issues that we bend the moral arc. It's the moral voice from our and many other religious traditions that can help to bend that arc towards justice. Parker was not alone. Unitarians and Universalists stood against slavery, against segregation, against unjust laws denying the right of women to vote. We stood with those fighting for universal suffrage, with those with all the social reformers of the 19th century, with Dr. King and the civil rights movement of the 60s, with gay and lesbian and transgender folks in more recent times. Time and again, when asked the question, where is our church? We have answered that we are standing on the side of love, on the side of justice. We are standing with the oppressed, with the poor. No faith tradition has a stronger history of standing up against injustice than we do. And at times a call has gone out to add our moral voice to the pressing issues of the day. In 1965, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. called on Unitarian Universalists to join him for a mass moral march in Selma, Alabama, and many of our clergy and lay leaders responded. You may not realize this, but more Unitarian Universalist clergy were with him than clergy from any other denomination. A Unitarian Universalist minister named James Reeb and a Unitarian Universalist layperson named Viola Liuzzo were among those who answered the call. And at that Selma march, after eating at an integrated restaurant, the Reverend James Reeb and two other Unitarian ministers were badly beaten by white supremacists. Reeb died from severe brain injuries. His death shocked the nation. You might even remember that President Johnson referred to him as he spoke out for the passage of the Civil Rights Act. Preaching the eulogy at his service, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said, "James Reeb symbolizes the forces of goodwill in our nation. He demonstrated the conscience of the nation. He was an attorney for the defense of the innocent in the court of world opinion. He was a witness to the truth that men of different races and classes might live and eat and work together as brothers." Viola Liuzzo was a Unitarian Universalist from Michigan. She'd responded to the call in Selma as well, and she'd taken her car down volunteering to drive the marchers back from Selma. She had a young black man who helped her in that task. And about a year ago, I met a black man named Leroy Moten. He was the young black man who had helped Viola. Leroy told a small group of us how they were driving along Alabama Highway 80, going to get another group of marchers to bring them back, when a car full of white supremacist men from the Ku Klux Klan began following them and threatening them. Followed for more than 20 miles, Viola was scared, but she started singing freedom songs. Leroy witnessed the car pull up beside them and shoot and kill her as she was driving the car, which then careened off the road into a ditch. And the Ku Klux Klan members stopped to make sure they were both dead. And Leroy, in great pain, lay perfectly still, pretending that he was dead, and they left. These were our people. They were there as Unitarian Universalists. They are our martyrs, our saints, if you will. They lost their lives standing up for our principles. So what about today? Well, another call has gone out. A call went out from the Reverend Dr. William Barber, the president of the North Carolina NAACP, for Unitarian Universalists to join with our brothers and sisters across boundaries of faith and race to stand on the side of love. Again, thousands of UU clergy and lay leaders from around the country, including our Unitarian Universalist Association President Peter Morales, committed to be present at a mass moral march in Raleigh yesterday, which may have been, I still haven't been able to get the news exactly, but it may have been the largest social protest gathering since that Selma march in 1965. Yesterday, our people gathered under a banner in Alabama, just exactly like the one posted over the door on the wall of our new building. They marched along with the members of the NAACP and many people of religion from different traditions. But why? What's going on in North Carolina now? Well, it seems that the clock is turning back. Forces are trying to bend the moral arc the other way. There's a concerted effort in that state's legislature to deny opportunity, fuel the growing inequality, and essentially revive racism. As the Reverend Barber described it, there is an avalanche of injustice taking place. In response to that, a growing grassroots movement is calling people again to stand up against injustice and to stand on the side of love, equality, opportunity, and freedom. The movement is, I'm sure many of you know, is called Moral Mondays. And on the first day of each week, protesters gather and march. First, it was just to the State House in Raleigh, where each week more and more are arrested for civil disobedience. But now they gather all over the state, standing up for what's right. And it's not just in North Carolina now. It has spread to Georgia and other states where similar repressive actions are taking place. So specifically, what's happening in North Carolina and in several other states in our country? Well, Bill Moyers called it the implementation of the new golden rule. That is, those with the gold rule, and no other interests matter. There are laws being passed and policies being enacted by ultra-conservative legislatures and governors that are profoundly immoral and unjust. They are racist, classist, and undemocratic. They are promoting corruption and the undue influence of money and politics. And they are hurting the poor, children, and the sick while helping the rich get richer. A few months ago, at a Moral Monday rally, a 92-year-old black woman who had fought in the civil rights movement 50 years ago and worked on voter registration campaigns all her life, Rosanelle Eaton is her name, marched with her walker and was arrested for civil disobedience and taken into custody. She spoke to the crowd at a rally, and in that wonderful call and response style, she said something and they repeated it back. And with a strong voice at 92, she said, "I'm fed up." And they repeated it, "I'm fed up." And then she said, "I'm fired up." And they repeated it, "I'm fired up." And we should be too. So what should we be fed up and fired up about? Well, the first thing an ultra-conservative North Carolina legislature and governor did was gerrymander congressional districts in the redistricting process that happens every 10 years to assure that the elected officials would not actually reflect the voters of the state, but be skewed in favor of electing more of their kind. Now, I want to be clear. This game is played by both political parties throughout our country regularly. Whatever party is in power when redistricting time comes rallies their forces to control political boundaries in dishonest and totally non-geographic ways that result in absurd districts that are created not to fairly represent the people, but to skew the election in their favor. And it's a practice, no matter who's doing it, that we should be fed up with and fired up to change. But the tampering with the election process in North Carolina and the suppression of the right and ability to vote goes much further than that. North Carolina passed legislation that requires voters to present government-issued photo identification in order to vote, a practice which is proven to prevent many seniors, students, and the poor from voting. They repealed their same-day voter registration. They cut back on early voting, and they made absentee voting much more difficult. The legislature repealed a wonderful bill that had been passed in North Carolina, which had encouraged high school students to participate in the democratic process by allowing these students to register to vote through their schools prior to their 18th birthday so they would be on the voting list. Do you know the dishonest reason they advanced for repealing that? They argued that the voting list could be used by pedophiles to locate victims. Come on. They even passed a bill which would revoke the tax credit given to parents if their dependent college students' children registered to vote at their college and university address. And they required all voters to register their vehicles at the same address as their voter registration. The editorial board of the New York Times called this a blatant effort to reduce Democratic voting strength in college towns like Chapel Hill and Durham. And I want to make a point again. I don't care if you are a Democrat or a Republican. This sermon is not about which political party should win. It's about what's morally wrong. And no matter who does it, it is morally wrong to take actions that suppress anyone's right to vote and make it more difficult for them to participate in the democratic process. All these efforts tampering with the voting process to ensure people of color and young people and old people and poor people, especially working poor people, have difficulty voting, have been supported by very dishonest reasons. The proponents argue they are for the integrity of the electoral process. Yet every study shows that we simply don't have a problem with voter fraud. As that 92-year-old Rosanelle Eaton said, we should be fed up and fired up with this malicious game playing with our sacred electoral process. It's bad, but there's much more. The state legislature repealed the Racial Justice Act, which had allowed prisoners on death row to appeal their convictions based on racial discrimination. North Carolina had many model statutes, but they had a model judicial clean election law where all judicial campaigns were publicly funded to avoid elected judges being beholden to those who funded their campaigns. Now, with the repeal, a justice of that Supreme Court in that state right now, whose campaign was largely funded by the same group that funded the legislative district gerrymandering, is set to rule on the constitutionality of the very redistricting law. How do you think he's going to rule? They have passed a restrictive abortion act prohibiting the use of any state funds and forcing most clinics that provide abortions to close. The state has made massive cuts in public education and launched an attack on teacher salaries and benefits while enacting a school voucher system which benefits the wealthy and hurts poor children. Higher education has been drastically cut, and they've made it much more difficult for lower-income families to send their children to state schools. Finally, those things that are part of the very basic safety net have been cut or eliminated. In a state with the fifth highest unemployment rate in the nation, the amount of unemployment benefits has been reduced by 35%. The number of weeks for which one could collect these benefits has been reduced to between 12 and 20, down from 26. This prevents 170,000 North Carolinians from benefiting from federal emergency extended benefits, which require a minimum of 26 weeks of state support, which North Carolina had before. Lastly, the state has not only refused federal funds to expand Medicare benefits, as many states have, they have enacted bills that have made vital health care less available. One bill cuts the funding to a program that pays for children's health care and life-sustaining drugs for those suffering from AIDS who cannot afford their medication. I don't care where you stand on the political spectrum. It's morally wrong not to provide for the least among us, the sick, the children. It's morally wrong not to be fair in the distribution of money we spend on higher education. And it's so short-sighted not to provide for the educational and health care needs of our children. How can we not be fed up with this? And it's time to be fired up about it. I wish I could have gone to North Carolina yesterday. I thought about going, but having just been away for a month and with a meeting on Friday night and services on Sunday, I had to conclude it was just too much to try and fit it in. And I know most of us could not be there. But we were with those people, our fellow Unitarian Universalists and those of many different faiths who marched yesterday, who were fired up, and who let the world know that they were fed up. We answered the question, where is our Holy Church, by saying, with that banner and with signs, we're standing on the side of love. In Raleigh yesterday, those who represented us were doing just that. And we're doing that today, too. Shortly, I want to ask you to stand again, to stand and sing, to stand with commitment and hope and love in your heart, to stand for what's morally right and against what's morally wrong, to stand with truth, not with dishonest explanations for laws that suppress voters' rights or deny ill people care or cut education for our children or deny women rights. I invite you to stand and affirm that that moral arc of the universe, though indeed long, does bend towards justice. That doesn't mean that people won't try to bend it back the other way. It doesn't mean that the arc bends easily or automatically. The arc bends because we stand up and make it bend. I invite you to stand up angered by the injustice that we see happening in North Carolina and other places, but with love in your heart and with a commitment to fight the growing inequality between the rich and poor, between whites and blacks and browns. You know, justice does not lose. Love does not lose. There are setbacks, disappointments, political games, but these we shall overcome. With our help, the moral arc of the universe indeed does bend towards justice.